I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, said he. I never died, said he. In Salt Lake City, Joe, says I, and standing by my bed, they framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I ain't dead, says Joe, but I ain't dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe. I didn't die, says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life, and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize, went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers fight and organize, it's there you find Joe Hill, it's there you find Joe Hill. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 100 years dead. I never died, said he. I never died, said he. I'm Chuck Gregory. This is the New American Dream Radio Show, and we are streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. And remember, it's a listener-supported network. They really need your support. So head on over to revolution.radio or freedomslips.com and show them some love. They really deserve it. They keep two streams of audio going pretty much 24/7 and some really, really great shows. Our first guest of the evening is Sheena Powell-Zuri, and she's been on the second week of every show for a little while, and I'm pleased to have her on this fifth week. Welcome to the show, Sheena.
Hello. Happy Halloween, Chuck. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me to join on this fifth Thursday. What a day it's been, right? It's Halloween and lots of scary things are going on, and it has nothing to do with vampires or ghosts, but more to do notably with the ensuing investigation and impending impeachment hearings of our own president of the United States. I think there's so many similarities to what happened when Nixon was in the same predicament or a similar predicament years ago. Although we know that Richard Nixon was not actually impeached, he got out when the getting was good, but he, I'm sure, knew it was inevitable. But I have something that I would like to share with you that seems very apropos in light of what's happening today and with our president and the previous longtime contributor, Sherwood Ross, who was involved with your show for a very long time. He wrote a song about Nixon's drama, which he presented in his Greenwich Village days in New York City in the early 80s. So I thought, in light of today's vote in the House, it would be apropos to read the lyrics of this song. It's called "I Was Nixon's Plumber." So if I may, I'll read a couple.
Sounds great. Go ahead. Yes.
So this is "I Was Nixon's Plumber" by Sherwood Ross. I was a humble plumber, my friends just called me Jake. I reamed the White House toilets with my plunger and my snake. By luck, I learned some awful truth as I performed my chores. Now I'm rich and famous since I published my memoirs. Read, I Was Nixon's Plumber, just 1595. How I unstopped his toilet bowl and what I found inside. It's the in-depth book of Watergate, the truth they could not hide. Read, I Was Nixon's Plumber at just 1595. One day Nixon called me in. Phew, what a mess and stink. His toilet bowl was backing up, to say nothing of his sink. I need an expert plumber. You must unclog the drain. If I don't flush these papers, there'll be all hell to explain. While he brooded in his office, I quickly fished him out. My eyeballs began to pop. I bottled up my shout. I stuffed those papers in my bag. I took them home to toast. When I dried out the contents, I knew I had to call the post. Well, I was Nixon's plumber. My friends just call me Jake. I reamed the White House toilets with my plunger and my snake. By luck, I learned some awful truth as I performed my chores. Now I'm rich and famous since I published my memoirs. Read I Was Nixon's Plumber, just 1595, how I unstopped his toilet bowl and what I found inside. It's the in-depth book on Watergate, the truth they could not hide. Read I Was Nixon's Plumber, at just 1595. just a little taste. There's a few more verses, but
that's cool.
it's so cool. I think it's such a relevant song that you can just really substitute those words for the activities that are going on now in the White House.
Yes.
And
yeah.
the cover up that you can see, and I can draw comparisons to see if, you know, Giuliani was Trump's Gordon Liddy, you know. It's really uncanny what's happening.
Indeed. Well,
yeah, so we have a new group of plumbers over in the White House now. So
sure do.
Yeah.
The cast seems to change every couple of weeks or so, but he goes through an awful lot of help.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And the egregious lies that we're being told on a day-to-day basis is just astounding. And it makes it very difficult to even respond to, because how do you respond to something that is just so off the mark and so off the wall? Any intelligent, logical person would just have the jaw on the floor, not knowing,
right.
You know, how do you argue with crazy? How do you counter something that is just completely in left field? So it's a bombardment of misinformation and lies, and eventually we just grow tired of fighting it. And I think our president has led this action of trying to really just wear us all down until we can't fight anymore. And there is a tenet or some philosophy that says if you repeat a lie enough times, it can feel like the truth.
Right.
So, unfortunately, he was elected into office, and he does have a following. And there are people who support him and support his presidency. So we really need to continue to be vocal and active, and not allow that those egregious lies to affect us and to push us down and push us back and exhaust us. We need to keep singing, right? We need to keep.
Indeed.
We need to keep creating and need to stay vocal.
Yes. Mm. Yes. Definitely. at the same time, there are an awful lot of people that still believe in that guy.
This is true, and people that fought against him and against the ideals that Trump has resurrected in terms of racist ideals. Elijah Cummings, as you know, who just passed away recently, I think very young, is only in his 60s, right? And he was very vocal. And even the day before he passed, he signed a resolution to oppose and go against Trump's immigration stance on children with special needs or special medical needs. So he was very active, and not to mention the civil rights activism of Elijah Cummings in office. And we need to carry on the efforts of people like Elijah Cummings, and also Katherine Johnson, who in her early 90s also recently passed away, I think within days of Elijah Cummings. And she was one of the early reporters in the civil rights the civil rights era of the 60s, the civil rights movement of the 60s. And she was one of the few people that was allowed into Martin Luther King Jr.'s circle to report on what was happening. These people were very important in the movement and in the civil rights movement, and we have to stay loud, you know. And I feel through the songs of Sherwood, who was my mentor, a very good friend of mine, and a very, very big inspiration for my creative energy, I feel a strong sense of urgency in being an activist, you know, inspired by Sherwood to do a little bit of good with our art.
Yes, yes. Well, that's what I try to do, too. So tell me, do you have anything of your own that you might like to share with us tonight?
Well, I do. Before I forget, I do want to say that I am planning another poetry live event for the spring of 2020.
Oh, really?
I did 2 years ago for Sherwood Ross and all the poetry and music of Sherwood Ross, and then earlier this year I did a beat poetry event at Le Chat Noir. And my next poetry live event is likely going to be at the Olympia Theater, which is the historic Gusman Center in downtown Miami. So it's going to be another really great community poetry event with live music, you know, very irreverent, beautiful, impactful, activist type of poetry recited to live music in the beautiful Olympia lobby. So the theme is to be announced. So I want you to, you know, stay tuned for that.
Okay. Do you have a date for it yet?
It's likely going to be in mid to late February.
Okay.
So those details are still being worked out. So please stay tuned for that.
Well, I hope it will be on a night other than a Thursday so that I can get there.
Yeah, let's see. I know you have a long way to drive. So for sure.
Actually, I don't drive, but you know, I get around. There's lots of transportation. So anyway,
But if you're asking for you know, one of my poems, there's a poem that I would like to read. It's called Religion. And in the name of religion all over the world, you know, with respect to what happens with ISIS and Al-Qaeda and these terrorist groups, in the name of religion trying to commit horrible atrocities, you know, it's really against what religion and spirituality stands for. But I have a little poem called Religion that hopefully will be, you know, impactful or inspirational in some way. So if I can read that.
Please do,
This is called Religion. Amidst wars, sweet chaos, the old and young scurry and scatter in a nascent foreign country. A woman in white stands defiant and observant, her crisp attire unscathed in this hell. She is a beacon, a dear friend to all, acknowledging their pleads, glancing, but then turning away. An old man shouts to her, "Are you Christian? Do you have any religion? If so, we are all doomed." a few walk through an unscathed archway together, utterless, and part ways in a glass building impervious. Children's malevolent shrieks convey, "It's just a game," as distraught mothers look on, salty tears covering their faces. That's it. Religion.
That was wonderful and horrifying.
Thank
at the
you,
same
Chuck.
Time.
but there's wow. There's death and there's peace and that. We can never lose sight of the beauty in the world, and even in that hell of war and of fighting, there is something good there. And I believe if we can identify what that good is and connect with that good and not have fear with the connecting with that good, it's a step towards healing. And we are a global society. We are not just one country where we need to be great. No, we need to be great as a world, as a global community. So I hope that we can continue to move in that direction.
We need to be a great part of the team, not the show off only one.
That's right. So. That's right. Exactly. We're all in this together, Chuck.
Yep.
Aren't we?
We are indeed.
Well, I thank you very much for having me on. It's been such a great time. I really appreciate it, and I want to keep you posted on the next Poetry Live event.
Absolutely.
That I'm producing in the community, and I insist that you be there. And please stay tuned for those details, and I look forward to being back on the show, Chuck. Thanks for having me.
Okay, and yes, you'll be back with us in just 2 weeks. So
absolutely. Looking forward to it. Thank you so much.
Okay, well, thanks again, very much. Bye bye.
Thank you, Chuck.
Okay.
Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween. Halloween, huh? Well, you know, we haven't had a single person come by for trick-or-treating. We got ourselves some candy, but it looks like we're going to have to eat it all ourselves. Don't you hate it when that
happens?
Well,
that's not too bad, right? There's Nate Silver, the statistician. He was famous for the 538. He has a website called the 538.com, and,
oh, really?
And 538 is the electoral votes, right, that are needed to elect our president.
Okay.
And he started these statistics by predicting presidential elections. Mm-hmm. So he was always spot on, and over time he expanded his statistics to sports and science and health and economics and culture. And he does have a statistical analysis of Halloween candy, and presents which is the best candy. I'm pretty sure Reese's Peanut Butter Cups is a winner again.
Oh, really? Okay. Well. we got the little Hershey's nuggets, but
well, take it easy with the leftovers, Chuck.
Yeah, I'll try not to finish them all tonight. I'll tell you, I really do miss talking to Sherwood, hearing his voice. He was a great contributor on this show for so many years.
Yeah, he really was. I miss him very much too. And even reading that song about Nixon's Plumber, where he was a regular in the Greenwich Village folk music scene and really made a name for himself performing such offbeat songs like this.
Yeah,
and he made such an impact. And of course, several weeks ago, I read some of his poetry about John Meredith.
Yeah.
And I know you have some of his archives on the site. Is that right?
Yes, I do. I probably should find a good one and play it back on a show one of these days. Not quite ready yet.
Yeah, right. The best of. But I hope that that we have a good outcome to these proceedings that happened today in the House, and that our democratic system will play out and will produce the correct and just results to preserve our democracy. I think it's very critical that we go through this process, and the notion that that these proceedings are not right or not fair. This is our law. These are the rules that we wrote for our country and how we proceed. And I have every confidence in those procedures, and that they will give us the just outcome. So I think that the opposers of the impeachment inquiry really need to step back and look at that process and allow the process to come through. If the process shows that our president didn't do anything wrong, and that the politicians that are bringing these charges to the forefront are wrong, then we need to show that too. So either way, it needs to play out. And our rules are written as such that we can go through this process and fairly come to a correct and right conclusion.
Yeah. Well, it will be interesting to see how things play out. I don't know. We do live in interesting times, but despite that being a Chinese curse, I rather like living in interesting times. So there.
Well, that gives us a lot to talk about, doesn't it, Chuck?
It sure does. Sheena, thanks again for being on the show. We're coming up on our station break now, and in the next half hour, we'll be having Philip Ferrugio with It's the Empire, Stupid. Talk to you on the other
side
of the station break, folks. Thank you, Sheena. Bye-bye.
Have a good night.
Find some comfort at Willow's World. A variety of news, commentary, and poetry at Willow's Poetry Corner, where there are comfy cushions and a tempting selection of delectable comestibles. A show that's quirkily and quintessentially British, with a unique twist featuring Willow Andreasen, your host. Join Willow Mondays and Thursdays, 2 till 4 p.m. Eastern Time, Studio A.
travels to Earth through the rainbow crystal bubbles from the furthest reaches of space and time, across the dimensions, through the elements, and in harmony with the colors of the universe. Through her mastery of abstract stream of consciousness malapropisms, she weaves a web of comic, satiric, cosmic conversation. Her subjects can range from Norman, the goose next door, to astrology and Earth changes, and into the deep recesses of the soul matrix. She holds a wealth of knowledge on herbs, plants, and astrology. Join Mona and her guests on Adventures of a Feral Hippie as she touches the earthly radio waves 5 days a week at 2 p.m. Monday to Friday on Studio B at Revolution Radio.
Extendivite really works. Just listen to what some people have to say.
Several years ago, I was developing a very severe situation. I called it my flippy heart. It was doing not good things. And I did not want to go to a medical doctor because I just knew they would give me a cover-up pill. I didn't want to get onto that sort of thing at all. When I learned it was garlic and cayenne is a healer. It is a wonderful herb. I said, I think I'm onto something here. I'll tell you, I wouldn't be without it. It did wonderful things for me.
Extendivite is only $69.95 for a 2 month supply of either capsules or liquid. Call now. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
Hello.
You're listening to Revolution Radio,
okay, we'll be on the
FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Our next guest of the evening is Philip Ferrugio, who joins us from Port Orange, Florida. Philip, you're going to start off as usual with
It's the Empire Stupid. This is a little bit different approach, maybe because it's Halloween, but this is a little different piece. It's called Never Had a Chance. It was 1956, Brooklyn, New York, the year after our beloved Dodgers had finally won a World Series from those damn Yankees. We kids on Day Hill Road were the children of Howdy Doody, for that was the show that all 5-, 6-, and 7-year-olds cherished each afternoon. I can still remember playing outside on Roy Edelstein's perfect baseball diamond stoop, a game I invented to mimic our Dodger heroes, as we slid around on the concrete slab on many an afternoon. At a designated time, the windows would open up and a symphony of moms would yell out, "It's Howdy Doody time!" Kids throughout the block would scramble into their two-family homes, everyone it seemed, except for Richie D. No, for some reason he would not retreat around the corner of Avenue P to his walk-up apartment above John's Superette. He just hung out by himself. Richie was 1 year older than Roy, Johnny, M, and me, which was a big thing then. Richie was also much taller and more robust than the three of us, and we all feared him. I guess he would be in the category of a semi-bully, because Richie was not that mean. Rather, looking back, Richie was a very angry kid. We knew from what he did tell us that he lived with his mom and his baby brother. He never spoke of a father, and we knew not enough to pry. As is the case in most urban areas of small towns, gossip travels faster than the common cold. The gossip was that his father was in jail and had been there for a long time. I can remember one incident that somehow lingers in my memory bank all these 60-plus years. It was one of those perfect spring Saturday afternoons when just about the whole block of neighbors were out on their stoops or washing cars or doing some fixing up of their homes. Of course, half the families on Dejo Road were actually renters, like my family. Still, it seemed that this bright sunny day had a myriad of folks enjoying the afternoon. You can hear the many different types of music, or perhaps one of New York City's three Major League Baseball teams' games. Roy, Johnny, and me were out there playing with our air rifles, and I believe Roy and I were wearing those coonskin hats like Fess Parker wore on the Davy Crockett show that we watched. Suddenly, a car screeched right within inches of Richie D as he apparently tried to dodge across the middle of the highly trafficked street. The driver got out and started yelling at Richie, and then a few neighbors began yelling at Richie to get the hell home where you belong. Richie looked frightened, and that quickly turned into rage as he cursed everyone out and ran up Dejo Road. I think it was perhaps a short time later when Richie approached me in front of my house. You want to come to my birthday party Saturday? I said, sure, and asked what time. I told my mom, and with all her faults that she might have had, my mom always liked the underdog and the vulnerable. I can remember her always feeding the birds in our backyard with all the scraps of bread that we did not finish at dinner. She never wanted to waste anything, always giving the leftover pies and cakes or dishes that my dad cooked, he was a gourmet cook, to her two next-door neighbors, Molly and Shirley. She told me she would get a present for Richie and a card to give him. When Saturday came around, she made me put on a nice pair of pants and a clean shirt and reminded me to be polite to Richie's mom. She knew, as did most of the women on the block, that Richie did not have a dad. She then walked me to the corner of Avenue P and across the street. Call me when you're finished and I'll come and get you, she said. That was one of her faults, being very overprotective. I went to the doorway next to John Superette and rang the bell inside the hallway. The buzzer rang and I went in. Richie was waiting for me at the top of the stairs. I went up and handed him his present and his card. He had this rarely seen big smile on his face. We went inside the apartment, and the first thing I noticed was how dark it was. Really ominous and very bleak. His mom stood there with Richie's little four-year-old brother. She was a tall woman, much taller than my mom, and she had this pale, almost ghostly complexion. His brother had the same appearance. She was very nice to me and sat me at the kitchen table, but there was no one else there. I mean, no one, not even his grandparents or uncles or aunts, no one. My seven-year-old heart was saddened by this. I can almost touch the forlorn look on all their faces. Years later, when I went back to Dejo Road to visit where my grandparents still lived, I asked my grandfather, whatever happened to Richie D? Oh, he died last year of an overdose or something. Bad kid. I didn't realize it then as an 18-year-old college student, but perhaps if Richie D and his sad-eyed mom had gotten counseling, well, who knows? He was a textbook case of a troubled boy, unable to be disciplined in school, with an equally troubled mom, both living on the edges. Therapy was for those who could afford it, then and now. When half of our tax revenue goes for spending on phony wars and overkill weapons, there's not enough funding for a safety net for troubled souls. Every public school should have one psychologist on permanent staff, instead of having only one solitary psychologist to service a myriad of schools in a school district. Women like Richie D's mom should have been able to get regular counseling for what ailed them. Nothing has changed, perhaps only for the worst. How many more Richie D's do we have to see destroy their lives or others' lives before we realize that they never had a chance? Thank you.
Oh, Phil, that was really something.
I'm having trouble hearing you, Chuck.
That was really something, Phil.
Oh, good.
And Richie D clearly made quite an impression on you.
Mm-hmm. It was a sad story. I was always a sensitive kid, and I don't know, just I could just kind of size him up, not right away, but, you know, for the first, maybe the first year that I knew him on the block, you know, I didn't like him, and I was, but then, when I went to that birthday party at his house, as the apartment, it, everything just kind of fit together, you know, this kid that was so troubled, and then his mother with that, I mean, I can never forget that sad look on her face. And she was like a woman who never went out in the sun. You know, she was so pale. And I think she was wearing dark clothing, too. And his brother had that same pale complexion that the mother had. And, oh, God, it was just so depressing. you know?
Eerie.
And I just, I really felt for him. I really did. I never knew what happened to him until my grandfather told me, because I moved away like a year later. When I was 8 years old, I moved to a different area, you know? So, actually, Roy Elstein became a dentist.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, you're living in Maryland. Yeah, he was a dentist in Maryland. Johnny M. Got a job with the phone. He went to Brooklyn College, too, but I think he dropped out, and he got a job with the phone company. And I ran into him when I was in my mid to late 20s, and, you know, he said he was working for the phone company. Yeah, it's a, you know, Chuck, I don't know if you had those experiences growing up, because we're about the same age group.
Yeah.
Maybe you're a little younger than
me. Of course. I ran into lots of different people, you know, in different circumstances. And, you know, sometimes it was quite a shock to see.
Well, the reason why I'm bringing this all up is that I have someone close to me, a guy, he's, you know, maybe 20-something years younger than me, but he's going through a lot of emotional, you know, he's emotionally disturbed. And, you know, when I tried to find a therapist for him, because someone else I know is going to this building on Long Island here, where there's a lot of therapists. There was a couple of different... Anyway, so I had met this guy when I was waiting for my friend to have his therapy. I was waiting in the lobby, I guess you'd call it, a building, and there was a guy I would always see. You know, he would be walking out one of his clients or patients to the elevator, and I don't know, I started talking to him. He looked maybe, I'd say, in his early to maybe mid-50s. He just seemed like a very positive guy, you know, and so I wanted this friend of mine to maybe go to him, you know, for therapy.
Right.
So I asked him, I said, you know, I have a friend, and he has, you know, Florida health care. No, he says, it's not covered by the insurance.
Right.
You know, I'm not a psychiatrist. He said, I'm just a master of, you know, social work.
Right.
So I asked him he said, I'll send an application for your friend to fill out. So I gave it to my friend, and on the thing it said, each session is $120 cash.
Wow.
Or credit card.
Yeah.
And I called the guy up, and I said, you know, I said, my friend, he has the insurance, but you don't take the insurance. I said, you know, he can't afford that. And he goes, yeah, it's maybe he just looked for someone else, you know. But that's the story, Chuck.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all about the money right now.
Yeah, people like you and me who are not, you know, very wealthy, and, you know, okay, I'm on Medicare. Are you on Medicare yet?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, okay, so we're on Medicare, and there are places for therapy where we could go. But what about someone like the guy I know who's 20-something years younger than me?
Yeah.
Who's not on Medicare.
They've got a long time with basically no care, because, I mean, if you don't have a lot of money, it's a mess. Obamacare was called the first year it came out, but then all the prices went crazy because the insurance company said, oh, this is a way to make money.
Yeah. And they don't cover... Very few insurances, you know, cover therapy. If you go to a psychiatrist.
Right.
But you know how hard it is in where I live in this area to even see a psychiatrist? First of all, here's what I found out. I had, in the early 80s, I was really lucky. I had a gambling problem. I was not lucky to have a gambling problem.
Right, I
hear you. Because of my gambling problem and my problems with my first wife, when we got separated, she blamed it all on the gambling, but it was much more than the gambling. The gambling was the offshoot of a horrible marriage. Okay,
right.
A very unhappy marriage. So anyway, I think my parents actually, they found out about this because I had insurance then, 1980. So
yeah, right.
And I have my own business, so I had insurance.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, the insurance in those days was a lot different than now. You know.
Yeah.
It was a lot better. It was a lot better.
Yeah.
So I had insurance, and my parents found out about a psychiatrist that treated gamblers.
Mm-hmm.
So I made the appointment. I promised that I would go to him. And it turned out that he was a Freudian psychoanalyst.
Huh.
He was an old Jewish gentleman. At that time, he was probably in his early 80s. And he had Parkinson's disease, so he would shake. He would shake, you know.
Yeah.
And anyway, I started with him, and I went every week, once a week. And I had old textbook Freudian psychoanalysis.
Mm-hmm.
When you lay on the couch, you know, the whole thing, right?
Right. Wow.
And okay. I went to the guy for 3 years, and the guy just opened up doors to me. I mean, he taught me so much about myself. It was Chuck. It was absolutely amazing. The reason why I'm saying that is I did some, you know, some inquiries with. There's very few psychiatrists now. There's hardly any that do psychoanalysis.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like
they're
it's all
just, yeah.
Okay, try this pill and this one to counteract this, what this one does to you, and then this one because those two, oh, those together, they're a mess, and you got to have this one to fix it up.
It's true. It's true, but the only thing that they do, if that's a poor way of saying it grammatically, a do-do, but the only thing that they do, one of the things that they do is they will refer you to a therapist that works with their practice. But the therapist is like the guy that I saw in the lobby. They're just, you know, usually masters of like social work or of like counseling. And they're very qualified people. They're very qualified people.
Yeah.
But they're not but they don't do analysis. They just do therapy, you know, where you or counseling. You sit and you tell them your problems, and they try and they help you with, you know, coping with it.
Right.
But what I had, Chuck, I'm telling you the truth. Anybody listening to this, Freudian, I don't know, they give Freud a really bad rap. And, you know, Freud might have been a little bit weird, whatever. But Freudian psychoanalysis is enlightening. It is unbelievable, Chuck. He taught me about why I felt the way about my mother and my father. And where it came from, and he actually helped me to forgive my mother, because my mother, you know, rejected me because of her upbringing. You know, it was dysfunctional, and she rejected me by being overprotective. You know, anyway, I learned all these things. It was great, and I learned about gambling. I learned why you gamble, and I learned about relationships. You know, with my ex-wife and. Certain things are not meant to be, you know. But anyway, it's everyone should have it. Everyone should have psychoanalysis. I mean, especially the guy who's in the White House right now.
Boy, yeah, right.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I've always found interesting about psychoanalysts is that before they're able to be qualified to practice that, they have to go through it.
Yeah, and they're usually MDs. They're MDs.
It is an MD kind of a title. Yeah,
right,
absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
Psychoanalysis is great.
Yeah.
I don't know if you ever. Did you ever experience any sort of psychoanalysis?
When I was a kid, I did. I guess I was 11, 12, 13, somewhere in there.
But. The thing I was getting in with this piece, as you know, because you read it, you heard it, was that there nowadays, especially, it's worse now than it was back in the 50s and 60s. Now there are so many more young people that are screwed up, okay?
Yeah.
There's so many more dysfunctional families. It's like a myriad of craziness that kids are raised under. And it's so sad. I mean, I taught in 1986, I taught high school, and I taught health ed. And in my homeroom class, I mean, the kids would come in the morning, A lot of them didn't even have breakfast, and they would sleep on, you know, while they're waiting for the first bell. They would just like put their heads down on the desk, and then they would bring in junk food. Oh my God! I mean, I'm teaching health ed, and I got these kids coming in. You have no idea. I mean, the kids would come in the in the classroom with you know, those candy bars and those ring ding, uh-huh, whatever you call them, donuts and yep, Pepsi and Coke, yeah, and all kind. And so one day, let me tell you what happened. This is a funny story. So one day, I was only teaching for I came in the middle of the term because the lady got ill and I replaced her. So I came in the middle. So the first day I'm watching these kids come in with all this crap. The second day I'm watching them come in. The third day I said, that's it. I said, okay, tomorrow anybody comes in with any of that crap, I'm confiscating it from you. Oh, you can't do it. No, I can do that. I'm gonna take it away from you. I said, you know what? You want to bring stuff to eat? You can bring a sandwich. You can bring a juice drink. You can bring raisins. You can bring nuts if you want to eat nuts. You can bring all kinds of fruit. I said, but that's it. No soda, no crap, pastry. And they were bitching him. And you want to laugh, Chuck? I'm not making this up. By the end of a week, they loved it. They were coming in, Mr. Frugio, look what I got today. I got a peanut butter sandwich. Mr. Frugio, I got raisins. Mr. Frugio, I got an apple. Mr. Frugio, I got apple juice. Yeah, they acclimated to it.
Wow.
Yeah, so, you know, there's always hope. There's always hope, but unfortunately, you know, but anyway, getting back to Richie D and his mother.
Yeah. Kids are amazing creatures. If we could just give them some positive influences and positive examples, they are great. And if you show them all kinds of bad stuff and do bad stuff to them, they're not going to be so great.
Yeah, it's just sad, Chuck, that there are so many kids. Teenagers or even younger, of course, but let's say teenagers in middle school. Let me tell you something.
Yeah.
I was offered, I had a friend of mine who was a gym teacher in a junior high school in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
And he got me in as a substitute teacher because I didn't have a license.
Right.
And I was there for about 3 or 4 days in a row. And he comes to me and he says, Phil, he says, I can get you a permanent position here. And I said, Arnie, I will never teach in junior high school. Are you crazy? I go, these kids, they're animals. The girls are worse than the boys. The girls are like wild. They're like fighting and yelling. 12-year-old. No, I said, I will only teach high school. That's it. At least when they're in high school, they're 15 or 16. They're already, they're already past all the puberty.
They have a whole different set of problems.
Yeah, they have a whole different set of problems. In the school I taught in, Chuck, 1986.
Yeah,
it was a big school in Queens. Big school.
Right.
Thousands of kids.
Right.
100 girls had babies. 100
You're
girls
kidding.
Had babies.
Oh,
no, not
God.
That year, 100 different girls had babies.
Wow.
And I saw why. Because the girl could have been chubby, unattractive, whatever you want to call it, not very, not a real social butterfly.
Right.
When she had that baby and she came back to the school with her little baby, she was a celebrity.
Really?
Was a celebrity. Oh, yeah. All the girls would go to her, and she was like a big celebrity. She had a baby.
Wow.
And unfortunately, that's what happens. And then it'll wear off, because she's a single mother, obviously.
Right. Yeah,
17 years old. It's sad, but you know what? We need counseling.
Counseling, honestly. Is good.
I mean, I have a friend who's a school psychologist down here. He says he goes to about 8 different schools. It's ridiculous.
Yeah,
it's ludicrous. One for every school minimum. There's so many kids with problems, and the money goes to the military spending. Half of your tax money, Chuck, goes to military spending.
I know, Phil. Yeah.
A lot of people don't know. That's a problem.
I know.
And Anyway,
you tell them they won't believe you, half of them, but yeah.
No, they won't believe you. And it's sad because think about how better it could be if Richie D had counseling, he wouldn't have killed him. He wouldn't have been killing himself with drugs.
Yeah.
And his mother, maybe she would have got a life for herself, you know?
Right.
And it's just so sad. I mean, you see it too, I'm sure, you know.
Yeah.
People you know, right?
Sure.
It's sad. Anyway.
Yeah, it's all rich against poor, you know? Anyway.
Yeah, it is. It is. And that's the sad part of everything, is that we celebrate wealth. You know what? We shouldn't celebrate wealth. We should look at wealth and say, why does it have to be this way?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, we're almost done here, Phil. Why don't you tell me, did you have any Halloween visitors tonight?
No, I didn't, as a matter of fact.
We didn't either. Wow.
No, we had none. Zero. I guess a lot of the parents only go to homes that they know, you know?
Yeah, right. Lorraine says I ate the whole candy. No, I didn't eat it all yet. I might later.
Well, Chuck, you know, I remember the words of a famous cannibal. He said, I'm going to have some friends over for dinner tonight. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Very nice talking to you, Chuck.
Great talking to you.
It's been a pleasure.
Too, Phil. We'll talk
it's to the
you
Empire next Stupid. Time. Give everybody my our website. Yeah, give it to
The column that Phil opened with is up on itsTheEmpireStupid.com. Go check it out.
Thank you, Chuck. Right. Talk to you next
week. Thank you, Phil. All right.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. In our next segment, we'll be having Michael Annis, who has something really good for us, I think, and we'll talk to him real soon. Here comes the station break. Well, I don't seem to be hearing a station break as I normally would expect right now. So let me just... So let me just remind everyone that we are streaming live, I hope, on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. It's listener-supported radio, and they deserve your support. Head on over to revolution.radio or freedomslips.com. And I just heard myself in the background there. So this stream is working, and we're just going to go right on with our show. This is the New American Dream Radio Show. And so I am going to bring in our next guest of the evening, Michael Annis. Michael joins us normally in the fourth week of each month from Denver, Colorado, and he has agreed to be part of this Halloween show, so I'm going to be getting him in right about now, and let's see, should be right here. All right. So Michael is
hello,
Michael. Welcome to the show, the New American Dream, and happy Halloween and happy birthday.
Happy Halloween to you too. Hey man, I'm Halloween 365 days a year.
All right.
Okay, so it's good to be back on the show, Chuck. And tonight on this fifth Thursday of the month of October 2019. I'm going to continue my presentation of the work of Frank Winters, the poet, whose book I published in 1982 through Howling Dog Press. And I've got to kind of get on it because I got a lot more material. I didn't realize how much material I had about this guy. But he was
all right. You go for it.
Yeah, he was somewhat of a mentor to me, and he made me tougher. I had just started publishing at the time. He made me a lot tougher than I was when I began, and it was quick, believe me. He wrote outside the norms of what was considered to be sanctioned authentic, in quotes, authentic poetry. And he lived a life where anything and everything could be considered art and poetry. Like Trump, believing all of his own tweets, Frank essentially believed his own writings, using them for psychic defense, and moreover to attack offensively things that he thought either threatened or insulted him. He wrote about motorcycle gangs. He hung out with tattoo artists that tattooed motorcycle gangs. He had a stepdad who rode a motorcycle. He would take me to biker bars and clubhouses, but I never once saw Frank ride a motorcycle because I believe they potentially threatened his own safety. He always drove a flat black VW bus that he had named the Black Maritia. And there was a reason for that, which I'll get to later. He might talk trash about setting a biker gang on someone, but he didn't have the influence, power, or brotherhood with them that he craved. Even though he wrote profusely about his experiences, he lived in an ever-engulfing world of his own making that he invented through fantasies. And all the while, he was consistently and often profound and disturbing poet. He was a Don Quixote figure dressed in black leather, motorcycle boots, sunglasses, and beret, who relied on his mother to get him through tough times, which she did. With all of these remarks that I'm making, I wanted to be clear to the New American Dream audience that I much admired Frank, and he was my friend, and I loved him. So getting on with that, I will say some things which really aren't all that complimentary, and he viewed himself more often than not in less than complimentary terms. He wrote prolifically about his family as heroes, and actually, at least metaphorically, as he recounted and reinvented their lives, they were heroes. One poem, Joe Winters, about his uncle, and I'm turning to it right now, goes, Joe Winters, for my father's brother. Joe was a fugitive from the sky. It haunted him at night, the limbs of trees twisted high. Drinking his wine from a wide-mouthed jar, feeling his way along the side of the railroad tracks, walking in the cracking pea gravel between the gray beams that separated the tracks, Joe saw himself as a personification of the things he loved. The trees, of course, were branches, made distort black gestures in the window panes of backyards or skyscrapers. He was a tree trimmer, and when he cut the limbs of the trees at their highest points, the sky would talk to him. There will never be another you, Joe. There will never be another you, the sky would whisper. And he worked tirelessly, listening to the skies he traveled in and the network of tree limbs that carried his personal symmetry. His ewe lamb was ever pressed to his lips. He heard the sky clearly. Be drunk, Joe. Joe, be drunk. The night permutations of stars hewed after his spirit to be drunk, found that structure endlessly rocking in his head, followed the hobo camps along the tracks. Be a sheep, sleep by the rusted forks of split rails and gray timbers. Joe, wavering there, alongside the moving train, staggering drunk, as if the hand of God kept him from being hit. And then, as if in a dream, the explosion of filtered red light and steel and the phallic space occupied by death. Your blood and mind swirls in space, split penis, ass, and unmarked face dragged 40 feet in pea gravel. Train leaning from the rails crosses your path, and you're dead. No more the sky-drawn voices to attune to your many gymnastic dances on aching branches of Winters. Joe Winters, died on the tracks. Not junkies' tracks like New York ghettos, but in a stockyard hitching rides on fast trains through Denver. And when I was a boy, I remembered he had taken some cowboys wielding picks into his guts. So the steel of railroads and picks are in my guts too. I have my promise to this Cherokee blood to make sculpture in memory of Joe's life and our lives. I love the loser dead on desolated rails that carry our grievances into hell with a good-natured smile. And he would often date his poem. This one was Little Italy, New York City, 1972. So he saw his family as being essentially a carved-out space where he could feud and express his artistic temperament without being ridiculed. Here's how Frank describes it through his mother. My mother was raised in an immigrant ghetto in Denver called Retreat Park, where her father slaved in a smelter. The owner of the smelter lived on the hill above my grandparents. He had massive dogs wandering his property, and the huge house where he lived looked haunted. The smelter towered over the entire neighborhood like a monolith raised to a despot. It is believed that they refined radioactive ore there. When it rained, the wastewater would flood down the hill into my mother's front yard, sometimes her living room. The fears she experienced in childhood were exacerbated by the grim poverty and oppression on the hill from the capitalist who dominated his poor serfs. In this fiefdom, the poor immigrants had their churches and flower gardens, small recompense for the long hours of back-breaking struggle to survive. My grandmother, Machka, died of cancer that ravaged her entire body, cause unknown. A tragic gift for a woman who had been healthy, robust all her days until the very end. And that sets the tone for the book and how he would progress through his own artistic struggles in trying to describe the struggles of his family of immigrants as they came and were berated and insulted and had to work at all the jobs that nobody else wanted to work at. Even though they were working class heroes, they would find merit in what Frank did and what he wanted to be, and the validity of being a poet. Frank and I would go places together, and he would introduce us in any new setting as, in quotes, "We're poets." That's right, we're poets. Most of the places we went, that didn't count for much. We were often looked at as troublemakers. When his father died, I was there with him, and he cried on my shoulder, telling me I was the brother he never had. He was so socially estranged, even among fellow poets, and his reaction to that, since he was all but socially inept, was suspicion and often rage. When he acted out, or threatened to act out, his intensity was alarming, if not frightening. And I saw him rage many times, and I saw him pull his belt with his big motorcycle belt buckle out of his pants and wrap it around his right fist and wait, and just wait for somebody to give him trouble. He also claimed at one time to be Jack Kerouac's bastard son. He longed for the loyal camaraderie that a biker club would offer him, yet without a motorcycle, does a biker gang actually want someone hanging around solely on the merit of being a poet? According to Frank, he brought the incredible Jack Micheline to Denver to work with the Denver Union of Street Poets, of which Frank was a member. All those in DUSP were fine poets, and they gave readings, published anthologies, and actually made a film of three of their members in different locales and settings reading protest poems. And that was the nature of the poetry of the time. It was very much in protest of the social structure in which we found ourselves surrounded. Well, Frank and Jack Michelin were friends in the beginning, but then they had a falling out. Yet when it came time for me to publish his book, Frank asked me to write the intro, and Jack did. I'm sorry, Frank asked Jack to write the intro, and Jack did, and it wasn't flattering. Here's Jack's intro. By Jack Michelin, Kid's Fantasy, Poem for a Dead Sissy. Kid Fantasy was born in Denver, a bully boy with a dream. The name dropped Kid himself, played ball with Dylan Thomas, met Michelin in Soho, was Caesar's right-hand man, rode the elephant with Hannibal, spoke dope with Neil, was on the road with Kerouac, drove the Black Maria, buy gas with plastic cards, couldn't even hold a job. Hey man, poetry's a sissy's game. Became a poet, rode with Capone and Danny Proper, brought poetry to graph. It's easy to be a poet, man. Just write it down from drunks. It's easy to be a poet. Buy Marisol some gin with somebody else's money. Cop a house, get a free ride. A runner's world, kid. A belly full of pain. There's no easy way. Believe in lies. Salute Hitler. Carry a flag and a rod. Hustle names. And believe in poetry. He'll die in the desert of America carrying his box of poems. Long live poetry and Frank Winters. Jack Michelin. So, in Dadaist fashion, Frank, still wanting to print Jack's poem, wrote a retaliation to Jack's Kid Fantasy, and it goes like this. Kid Sissy, Fantasy in the Dead of Winter, to Jack Michelin. Kid Sissy had a sister that dressed him up in his mother's clothes. Kid Sissy wore high-heeled shoes. Kid Sissy wore garters. Kid Sissy wore flowers under the garter. Kid Sissy liked playing with his sister. He was a working-class kid. Thought he was Susan Hayward. Thought he was Ava Gardner. Thought he was Jane Russell. Kid Sissy was bullied by tough kids in the neighborhood. Kid Sissy got beaten up by the bullies on the block. Kid Sissy was hit in the head by dirt clods when a tough kid in the neighborhood spotted him on the front lawn. Kid Sissy was a sissy. His fantasy was to be beautiful. He was a crybaby. He was the son of a truck driver. His mom worked in the packing house. His dad was a deer hunter. He was frightened by hunting and was afraid of guns. Kid Sissy thought he was Betty Grable, thought he was Ann Sheridan, thought he was beautiful. Kid Sissy wore lipstick. Kid Sissy thought he was a dance hall girl. Kid Sissy liked it when his sister dressed him up and took pictures. He was a lonely child. He didn't fit in with the wild boys on the block. He read books and drew pictures. He wanted to do beautiful things. He was dominated by his sister. Kid Sissy was a poor kid from Globeville. Kid Sissy's fantasy was to be a great artist. Kid Sissy was called a sissy. He was given a bloody nose, was sad sometimes. He was a Catholic. He prayed at Mass. He would go to bars with his dad on weekends. Kid Sissy watched everyone get drunk. Kid Sissy would go on hunting trips and cry. Kid Sissy was beaten up by neighborhood kids. Kid Sissy was a child. Kid Sissy was the son of an Okie. He was the son of a Slovenian-American woman. Kid Sissy's grandparents were Slovenian immigrants northeast of Globeville. Kid Sissy grew up in a macho world. He was an easy target. He was a puppet. He was a fool. And the packing house and the truck drivers and the bikers and the construction workers had a fantasy. Kid Sissy suffered abuse. Kid Sissy wore mama's dresses. Kid Sissy wrote poems. Kid Sissy painted Jesus. Kid Sissy drew Harry Truman on a chalkboard. Kid Sissy painted Madonna and Child. Kid Sissy wore Maria's dresses. Kid Sissy listened to rock and roll. Kid Sissy had a fantasy. Kid Sissy wanted to be beautiful. Kid Sissy wanted to be an artist. He found a cruel world. He saw his fantasy die. He grew up and his fantasy died. He learned to love weapons. Kid Sissy became a street poet. Kid Sissy stopped wearing dresses. He beat up people. He stomped dudes. He made sculpture. He wrote stories. He found truth. He found an ugly world. Realized his fantasy was dead. Kid Sissy saw the death of his fantasy. He saw wars, saw death.
He knew the world. He saw pain. He saw beauty die. Kid Sissy saw coups. Kid Sissy saw tyrants. Kid Sissy saw death. Kid Sissy watched his fantasy die. Kid Sissy became a bully, carried a gun, carried a flag, hustled drinks and names. He became a name dropper. He watched beauty die. He hated the world. He had a fantasy. He lost all hope. Kid Sissy loved painting. Kid Sissy loved sculpture. Kid Sissy loved poetry. Kid Sissy watched his fantasy die. Kid Sissy got drunk and wild, got in fights. He had a bad attitude. He had behavior problems. He had the wrong values. Kid Sissy was a loser. Kid Sissy was a failure. Kid Sissy watched his fantasy drop dead. Kid Sissy was a dropout. He dropped out of painting. He dropped out of sculpture. He dropped out of poetry. He dropped out of the world. Kid Sissy watched his fantasy die. He watched beauty die. Kid Sissy hated the world. Kid Sissy did drugs. He did booze, was a dropout, was a puppet, was a punk, was a mama's boy, was a child. Kid Sissy wanted to be beautiful. Kid Sissy became a drunk. Kid Sissy read poetry. He painted pictures. He made sculpture. Kid Sissy had a dead fantasy. Kid Sissy had a dead fantasy. Kid Sissy had a dead fantasy. Kid Sissy was drinking gin. He liked famous poets. He liked famous sculptors. He liked famous painters. Kid Sissy was not famous. Kid Sissy was a flunky. Kid Sissy was a mama's boy. He was a loser. He was a failure. Kid Sissy improved his values. He changed his attitude. He improved his behavior. He changed his life. Kid Sissy wanted to live. He wanted to survive. He wanted to be like his heroes. But Kid Sissy couldn't cut it. Kid Sissy had enemies. Kid Sissy was betrayed. Kid Sissy was tortured. Kid Sissy overdosed on drugs. Kid Sissy was dead. Kid Sissy saw a dead fantasy, saw a dead world. He dreamed of success. Kid Sissy was a dead fantasy. Kid Sissy was stabbed in the schoolyard. He died a reluctant hero of the Denver streets. Kid Sissy was a bummer. Kid Sissy found the grave. Kid Sissy was the slave to his fantasy, was a slave to his dead fantasy. Kid Sissy was a slave to his art. Kid Sissy wanted to be Marilyn Monroe. Kid Sissy wanted to be a star. Kid Sissy is dead. Kid Sissy died chasing poets and poetry. Kid Sissy chases the ghost of Neil Cassidy in heaven. Kid Sissy chases Kerouac. Kid Sissy chases Dylan Thomas. Kid Sissy is dead. Long live poetry. Long live Jack Michelin. Long live the painter. Long live Bill de Kooning. Long live sculpture. Long live Marisol. Long live the sculptor. Long live Mark DeSouvreau. Long live music. Long live Phil Glass. Long live musicians. Long live Steve Reich. Long live the American artist. Long live the dead fantasy. Long live the desert of America. August 20th, 1982. Okay, I think I have so much more, but I think what I want to do is to make sure I read the final poem in the book, which is just called Afterward, and it reflects back on his time in Globeville and his family and so forth. Afterward, right. Air is bad northeast of Globeville. The roads are blocked and garbage strewn. The tall green weeds have overgrown the area. The haunted house from Maria's childhood still stands. The tombstones to Slovenian immigrants still erect. The gate to their home still swings in the breeze. The smelter, the railroad, the packing house, the disposal plant, the scrap metal yards, the trucking firms, the churches, and the bars along Washington finitely exist. The immigrant homes have all been razed. All that survives is industrial wreckage, is memories. The trees still stand as they did in photographs past. The view from the haunted house of Maria's childhood reveals industrial desolation, the industrial genocide of Slovenian immigrants, the long underpaid hours, industrial hell, crucified dead along Emerson Street, the strong backs of workers
and the silence finds cessation as a pigeon lands on a power wire. A butterfly floats slowly on its way through summer. There is nothing left. There is nothing there. There are only memories, the births and the songs, the deaths and the Christ, the labor and the poetry, the hard work and the dances, the parties and the prayers, the passion and the paintings, the drinking and the sculpture, the children growing, the children dying, the residents gone to graveyards, the old dead of cancer and heart attacks. The survivors seek poetic reason to what has happened. The poet disavows the facts, answer, inner vision. Kittens circling tall sunflowers, garden of Maria, words of Maria, memory of Maria, small cottages have been eliminated for industrial expansion. Tall trees remain standing by the love of Maria. O sanctified America, O genocide America, O desolation America, O lonely America, O dream America, bless us to the heart, bless us forever again.
Well, you made it.
I made it.
Hey, that was really good, Michael. And wow, but what powerful poems. Sorry I didn't get to meet this guy. He sounds like quite a character. You know, I don't know if I would have actually liked him, but I might have. I don't know.
Very few. You know what? Okay, so here we go. You know, the criteria is not to like someone. The criteria is to understand and to try to dig deep into their art and what they're trying to convey. And I had to do that as a publisher. Had to do that as a publisher.
Okay.
It's required. And
yeah,
it became somewhat of a love affair because he was such a pariah in so many ways. And yet he had so many beautiful lines to offer. He said of himself, "How do you overthrow the marrow of your existence?" And I printed that on the cover of his book.
How do you overthrow the marrow
of your existence?
Wow.
He struggled with that his whole artistic life of who he was and what he represented and no matter what he did, he couldn't change who he was. He couldn't fit in. You know, he was artistically estranged from everything around him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, well, Michael, thank you for joining me on this Halloween show. Just pretty much wraps up your segment, and it's really been great hearing you read, and sounds like quite a guy.
Yeah.
So, hey, the next time you're on my show, I will actually be in Denver. How about that?
Way cool, man. We have something way cool, I think, planned.
Hey, I think so too.
Yeah.
We'll keep.
I hope we can
up.
Bring it off. It should
All
be
right.
a great place for your audience.
Okay.
Okay, Chuck.
Thanks a lot, Michael. Talk to you. Well,
thanks
soon.
Always having me on.
Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye. Bye. Listen to Revolution Radio at Freedom Slips. We'll be right back after this message.
Find some comfort at Willow's World. A variety of news, commentary, and poetry at Willow's Poetry Corner, where there are comfy cushions and a tempting selection of delectable comestibles. A show that's quirkily and quintessentially British, with a unique twist. Featuring Willow Andreasen, your host. Join Willow Mondays and Thursdays, 2 till 4 p.m. Eastern Time, Studio A.
Worldwide, what's everything?
We talk about decentralization and bank annihilation. Bitcoin, Litecoin, Mycoin, Yourcoin, Blockchain, baby. Mondays at 1600 hours Eastern Studio A.
Extendivite really works. Just listen to what some people have to say.
Several years ago, I was developing a very severe situation. I called it my flippy heart. It was doing not good things. And I did not want to go to a medical doctor because I just knew they would give me a cover-up pill. I didn't want to get onto that sort of thing at all. When I learned it was garlic and cayenne, and cayenne is a healer. It is a wonderful herb. I said, I think I'm onto something here. I'll tell you, I wouldn't be without it. It did wonderful things for me.
Extendivite is only $69.95 for a 2 month supply of either capsules or liquid. Call now. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Well, welcome back, everyone, to the final segment of the New American Dream Radio Show. And our final guest of the evening is Frank Cordero. Frank joins us each week from the Des Moines Catholic Worker. He runs that place. And last week he was in Brunswick, Georgia. And he's going to be telling us all about that right about now.
Yo, Chuck.
Hello, Frank.
Well, I get your call. I'm in our kitchen,
and okay.
Today my sister, and my brother Joe, my sister Dee Dee, are cooking. So they're making homemade chicken noodles.
All right.
Stuff. So I'm just now coming back up to my room.
Okay.
Plus, I went to I did a first draft of my Via Pacis article that goes over what happened at the trial. I'd like to use that as my springboard for this week's sharing, so we can that trial done. It was an amazing thing. For me, personally, and the article will explain now. But before we do that, update on Jess and Ruby. Nothing new. Jess is in Duluth. Ruby's is somewhere in California or Phoenix or somewhere out there west, waiting for their lead into how they're going to defend themselves. So that can happen anytime because the first court date is December 2nd. So something will happen. Somebody will tell us something before that, or that might be the day we find out. But that's where we're at with those two. And they all are still in need of prayer and people who are willing and ready to jump on the bandwagon of support. That will be coming later. But today I want to reflect on my time in Georgia at the Kings Bay Plowshares trial. So just returned from Brunswick, Georgia, as the article begins, in a 3-day trial for the Kings Bay Plowshares 7. A federal judge on Thursday, October 24th, convicted seven Catholic, a federal jury convicted seven Catholic peace activists of three felonies and a misdemeanor for breaking into a nuclear submarine base in Georgia last year. The seven included five Catholic workers: Patrick O'Neill, Mark Colville, Carmen Trotta, Claire Crady, and Martha Hennessy, plus Jesuit Father Steve Kelly and Elizabeth McAllister. All are now facing up to 25 years in prison each for trespassing on the U.S. Navy base, which houses six Trident submarines capable of carrying hundreds of nuclear weapons. Sentencing to take place after the new year. On the night of April 4th, 2018, over a year ago, they cut into a padlock and later a security fence at Kings Bay Naval Submarine Base in St. Mary's, Georgia. They spilled human blood on a Navy insignia affixed to a wall, spray-painted anti-war slogans on a sidewalk, and banged on a monument to nuclear war with hammers made of melted down guns. The seven were caught more than an hour into their actions as three of the activists prepared to cut a heavy electrified fence leading to the nuclear storage bunkers. The U.S. government is claiming $31,000 in damages. The 12 jurors, nine women and three men, took less than 2 hours to deliberate. The jury's guilty verdict was the least surprising thing to happen during the three-day trial. The judge's instructions at the end of the trial made sure that the seven would be found guilty. The most important and telling thing about the 82 prospective jurors who formed the jury pool, from whom the 12 final jurors came from, was that not one of them, when asked, had an opinion on nuclear weapons. This is important because during their three-day trial, the seven Catholic activists presented an opinion regarding nuclear weapons and the six Trident submarines stationed at Kings Bay. Their legal argument was a Catholic faith-based and Catholic worker-formed defense that not only justified their April 4th, 2018 witness, it also exposed the immoral, unjust, and criminal reality that comes with hosting six Trident submarines in your hometown. As Claire Grady said so clearly from the witness stand, threatening to kill the whole human race with nuclear weapons cannot be legal. The seven who took pictures and videos of their actions did not deny that they committed the acts, but argued they were following divine law that called them to bear witness and speak truth to power, i.e. the U.S. government, to the immoral, unjust, and illegal reality of a Trident submarine. Early in pretrial motions, the seven and their attorneys cited the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, a 1993 federal law that says the government may not burden the faith practices of a person with sincerely held religious beliefs. And even though the judge did not allow them to use this law at the end of the trial, the judge did allow each defendant to speak freely of their religious beliefs, tell the stories of their faith-filled lives, how they, five of them, became Catholic workers, and why they believe what they did on April 4th, 2018 at Kings Bay was a, quote, prophetic sacramental witness in sync with being a faithful Catholic in the United States of America. For me, the most powerful moving moments in the trial were the personal testimonies of each of the defendants who took the stand, beginning with Martha Hennessy. Martha is a grandmother of eight. She's also the great-granddaughter of Dorothy Day and a member of the New York Catholic worker community. Martha spoke of the great influence her grandmother Dorothy had on her life growing up, that she left the church as a young adult and only returned to the church later in life and joined the New York Catholic worker. Martha is fully committed to the community and the service to the poor and to her grandmother's nonviolent ways for social change. Joining the Kings Bay Plowshares was just an extension of Martha's faith-based journey in the Catholic worker movement. Patrick O'Neill is a Catholic worker from Garner, North Carolina. This was Patrick's second Plowshares witness. He and his wife, Mary Ryder, raised their eight children at the Garner Catholic Worker. They identified themselves as an intentional pacifist Christian community that works to uphold the consistent ethic of life. Patrick used his reading of the scriptures to say, quote, "I draw a correlation with Jesus cleansing the temple, Jesus did this because it was a grave injustice, like nuclear weapons, making the temple a den of thieves." Matthew 21:13. Carmen Trotta from the New York Catholic Worker was my personal favorite. Karma got his start in the Catholic Worker in Des Moines. Originally from New York, Carmen came to Iowa to attend Grinnell College. He played football at Grinnell, and he also got introduced to the Catholic Worker in Des Moines. After graduation, he moved into our community. He spent several years with us in the 80s before joining the New York Catholic Worker. Carmen spoke clearly and with conviction. His testimony and life story, rooted in years of community life, service to the poor, and resistance to the U.S. military empire, from U.S. nukes to Guantanamo to ICE raids, Carmen has protested and witnessed against them all. The journey to do his plowshare started many years ago for Carmen. I've never seen him happier than he was on the witness stand. Mark Colwell is a founding member of the Amistad Catholic Worker Community and House of Hospitality in New Haven, Connecticut, where he lives with his wife, Luce. They raised six children together at the Amistad Catholic Worker. Their works of mercy surround the children in their neighborhood. When word got out that Mark was locked up and Luce needed help with the hospitality, Luce got the help she needed from the neighborhood friends and supporters. Mark told his story and faith journey, referring to his family, his father, and his Catholic faith. For Mark, the key word is integrity. We share a lot of similar history, and the issue of integrity has always been central to me, too. Now, Claire Grady, a Catholic worker from Ithaca, New York, is a mother of two. Claire is a second-generation Catholic activist. Her father, John, was close friends to Dan and Phil Berrigan. He was an actor in the draft board witnesses in the 60s and 70s. John's four daughters, Claire, Ellen, Teresa, and Marianne, are all Catholic peace activists, as are their children. Claire's testimony was probably one of the favorites of the courtroom crowd, mostly peace activists from around the country. Referring to the fact of the case, did the seven do what they said they did? Both sides agree they did. Claire pressed the point that the facts never stand alone. They must be placed in a context to have any meaning. The last two defendants, Liz McAllister and Father Steve Kelly, are not Catholic workers. They are among our Catholic worker peace activist mentors. Catholic workers showing up with Liz and Father Steve and a plowshares witness is like showing up with Moses and Elijah. Elizabeth McAllister, co-founder of Jonah House, widow of Phil Berrigan, previous plowshares activist, mother of three, 79 years old, and oldest of the seven. Liz has served as the matriarch of the Atlantic Life communities. When Liz took the stand, she brought the whole history and life and her Catholic faith into the trial record. Father Steve Kelly is the only defendant that we did not hear from. Representing himself, the only one of seven not free. Father Steve showed up in court in jail clothes and a sweater and returned to jail when the court was not in session. Father Steve Kelly is famous in our Catholic worker resistance circles, a multiple plowshares activist. He has logged over 10 years of jail time, most of it in solitary confinement for non-cooperation. He is the fellow Jesuit who gave the sermon at Dan Berrigan's funeral. Father Steve has been locked up in the local jail since the day of the witness on April 4, 2018. Father Steve chose to say nothing throughout the trial. No reason was given. Father Steve did not need to take the stand to make his witness known to the Catholic workers and fellow plowshares, friends and family. His life of nonviolent resistance to our empire in and out of prison is already known and beloved. For me, Father Steve's silence in the court represents the absence of a hierarchical Catholic clerical and teaching class. Six lay Catholics took the stand, presenting a Catholic defense for their April 4, 2018 plowshares witness. And I gotta ask, where is the local bishop, his priest and deacons? Were there no Catholics in the jury pool? How can a Catholic in Brunswick, Georgia, have no opinion on nuclear weapons? Why is the Catholic position on nuclear weapons left to the Catholic workers to defend alone? Just before the judge gave instructions to the jury, the U.S. attorney reminded the jurors that the religious motivations of the defendants should not get in the way of their deliberations, calling such considerations 100% not important. And the judge's instructions made it, and the judge's instructions made it very clear. The only facts that mattered to the U.S. government were, did the defendants destroy U.S. property and how much money did it cost? The juror's guilty verdict was locked in at that point. All but Kelly are out on jail. Kelly, who refused to pay $50,000 and wear an ankle monitor as conditions of his bail, remains in the Gwinn County Detention Center in Brunswick, Georgia. Sentencing is expected in 60 to 90 days. That's the article, at least the first draft. And that's the story I wanted to share this week with the
Well, that's quite a story. I appreciated your reporting from Brunswick last week, but the for some reason the recording was a little bit garbled. So I hope this week I think people will have heard better what you had to say. Thank you, Frank. That's all we got time for.
Next week. All right. God bless. Bye-bye.
I am so lucky to have Frank Cordero as a weekly guest. And that was quite a thoughtful article that he had about what's going on out there in that trial. So, I looked up a speech from Daniel Berrigan, who was somebody that that Frank mentioned in there, and this is a speech when he was aging a bit, but he'd been protesting for a half century by this time. This was on November 29, not sure what year. There's something that he had to say. I'm glad to say that in the long run, it's really coming into focus. Oh, sorry, that was somebody about him. I was trying to get the full text of this speech, but I did not get very far. Okay, here we are. Persevere. You have no right to tie yourself in knots because you want to know the outcome of what you're doing. Don't. Oh, no. Let it go. Let it go into history. Let it go into Christ. Let it go into generations. Let it go into the children. Play it and pray it well. This is, I guess, pretty typical of Berrigan. You may know Berrigan better for the Catonsville Nine. But he was just an amazing guy. He always was reflecting on what Dorothy Day had set up with the Catholic workers and so forth. And he was just an amazing activist, got himself arrested several times and burned draft papers in a very famous action. So so much. Anyway, let me move on. I'm going to get us kind of close us out here with a song. Before I do that, I would like to thank all of my guests. In the first half hour, I had Sheila Powell Zuri. And the second, I had Philip Ferrugio. In the third, Michael Annis. And then just now, Frank Cordero. I am blessed with a wonderful set of guests. And that's why I like to keep coming back to you every Thursday right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. And remember, it is a listener-supported station, so head on over there, freedomslips.com or revolution.radio. Look for that donation button and use it. That's what it's there for, you know? I mean, really. All right, then. Oh, I marched to the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British War. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't marching anymore, for I've killed my share of Indians in a thousand different fights. I was there at the Little Big Horn. I heard many men lying, I heard many more dying. But I ain't marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the war. It's always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land. Fought in the bloody Civil War. I even killed my brother and so many others, and I ain't marching anymore. For I marched in the battles of the German trench, in a war that was bound to end all wars. One must have killed a million men, and now they want me back again, but I ain't marching anymore. For I flew the final mission to the Japanese sky, set off the mighty mushroom roar. When I saw the cities burning, I knew that I was learning that I ain't marching anymore. Now the labor leaders screaming when they close the missile plants. United Fruit screams at the Cuban shore. Call it peace or call it treason, call it love or call it reason, but I ain't marching anymore. My final thanks go out to all of you listeners who have joined me on this night on the new American Dream Radio Show. I appreciate you being here. And I hope you'll head on over to newdream.us and, hey, say hello. I would like to know that you're out there. Thank you, and good night.
Safe? Do you have the necessary information to assist you in confidently living through just about any survival situation? Is survival and gardening, off-grid living, medical knowledge, or even natural or man-made EMPs on your list of personal concerns? Do you have your documents and your personal information in a safe place in your hands where you know where it is? Well, check out our preloaded EMP-proof thumb drive. Over 3 gigs of survival documents and how-tos, plus the USDA offline food preservation website, and much, much more, including a surprise bonus we just can't tell you about here. With plenty of room left over to store your most important documents, imagine if a megavirus or a computer failure took out your bank, or all the banks for that matter. Are your banking records safe in your hands? So when they get things fixed and repaired, you can say, hey, look, this is what I had. You have it. I want it back. Is your personal data safe? Family records, addresses, phone numbers? We'll squeeze on over to freedomslips.com. Yes, that's www.freedomslips.com. Click the banner on the homepage for the EMP-proof bullet drive to get the full scoop of everything that we offer. So, folks, keep your data safe for your peace of mind. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
This is the People's War. It is our war. We are the fighters. Fight it, then. Fight it with all that is in us. And may God defend the right.
Warning! Warning!
We gotta stop them! They're gonna kill us all!
See how the trouble you've started?
Be they a government, be they industry, be they organized labor, be they anyone, or human beings!
Time when the operation of the machine becomes so obvious. Makes you so sick at heart that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to win the day to the people who run it, to the people who own it. That unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported
talk radio station, throwing ourselves upon the gears of the machine. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps. You call